ours, and granted to each in turn his attention most humbling. Now all who would not bow are hewn at the feet to better help them kneel." Moncrain cleared his throat. "There, I have had my plea. I have taken command, shut those slack jaws, turned those gimlet eyes to the stage. I am midwife to wonders. With their attention snared, I give them history. We are back in the time of the Therin throne, of Salarius the Second, an emperor who went out and kicked some ass, just as we shall, perhaps accepting Sylvanus." Sylvanus rose and tossed his copy of the script aside. Janora managed to catch it before it hit the ground. "Chorus, you call yourself," he said. "You've the presence of a mouse fart in a high wind. Stand aside and try not to catch fire if I shed sparks of genius." If Locke had been impressed by the change in Moncrain's demeanor, he was astounded by the change in Sylvanus. The old man's perpetually sour, unfocused, liquor-addled disposition vanished, and without warning he was speaking clearly, invitingly, charmingly. "From war long waged comes peace well lived, and now 20 years of blessed interval has set a final laurel light upon the brow of bold, deserving Salarius. Yet heavy sits this peace upon his only son and heir. Where once the lion roared, now dies the faintest echo of warlike times. All eyes turn upon the cub, and all men wait to behold the wrath and majesty that must spring from such mighty paternity. Alas, the father, in sparing not the foes of his youth, has left the son no foe for his inheritance. Citizens, friends, dutiful and imperial, now give us precious indulgence. See past this fragile artifice. Let willing hearts rule dullard eyes and ears, and of this stage you shall make the empire. From the dust of an undone age hear living words on the breath of living men. Defy the limitations of our poor pretending, and with us jointly devise and receive the tale of Orin, son and inheritor of old Salarius. And if it be true that sorrow is wisdom's seed, learn now why never a wiser man was emperor made." "Well remembered, I'll give you that," said Moncrain. "But then anything more than 3 lines is well remembered where you're concerned."
"It's as fresh now as the last time we did it," said Sylvanus, 15 years ago.
"That's you and I that would make a fair chorus," sighed Moncrain. "But we need a Salarius, and we need a magician to advise him and do all the threatening parts, or else the plot goes pear-shaped."
"I'll be the chorus," said Galdo. "I can do this. Wake everyone up at the beginning, then sit back and watch the rest of you in the play. That sounds like a damn good job."
"The hell you'll do it," said Carlo. "You and that shaved head, you look like a vulture's cock. This job calls for some elegance."
"You see us wrong," said Galdo, "who are about to get your fucking ass kicked."
"Shut up, idiots," Moncrain glowered at the twins until they settled down. "It would be to our advantage to leave Sylvanus and myself free for other parts. So, yes, one of you may have the chorus. But you won't scrap for it in the dirt. You'll both learn the part and strive to better one another in it. I don't have to make a final decision for some time."
"And what does the loser get?" said Carlo.
"The loser will understudy the winner, in case the winner should be carried off by wild hounds. And don't worry, there'll be other parts to fill."
"Now," said Moncrain, "let's break ourselves up and put Alondo and our other Camorri through some paces to see where their alleged strengths lie."
3. The sun moved its way and the clouds moved theirs. Before another hour passed, the inn-yard was once again in the full light and heat of day. Moncrain donned a broad-brimmed hat, but otherwise seemed heedless of the temperature.
Sylvanus and Janora clung to the inn walls, while Sabitha and the boys darted in and out of cover as they were required to play scenes.
"Our young Prince Orin lives in his father's shadow," said Moncrane.
"He's probably glad to be out of the god's damned sun, then," panted Galdo.
"There's no glory to be had because Salarius II already went out and had it," continued Moncrane. "No wars to fight, no lands to claim, and it's still an emperor or two to go before the Vadrans are going to start kicking things over up north. As if that wasn't bad enough, Orin has a best friend named Ferin. Ferin's even hungrier for glory than Orin is, and he won't shut up about it. Let's do Act 1, Scene 2. Alondo, you do Orin, and let's have Giovanno give us a Ferin."
Alondo leaned back lazily in a chair. Jean approached him, reading from his copy of the script.
"What's this, lazy lion cub? The sands of the morning are half run from the glass. There's nothing in your bed 'tis worth such fascination. The sun rules the sky, your father his kingdom, and you rule a chamber 10 paces by 10.
Alondo laughed and answered,
"Why be an emperor's son if I must rise as though to reap the fields? What profit, then, in my paternity? What man lives who, more than I, has rightful claim to leisure?"
"He that has given you leisure," said Jean, "having carved it like rare meat from the bones of his enemies."
"Enough," said Moncrane. "Less reciting, Giovanno. Less formula."
Sure, said Jean, obviously feeling out of his depth. "Whatever you say. Alondo, take over, Ferin. Lucasa, let's have you see what you can make of Orin."
Locke had to admit to himself that Jean was the least comfortable of the five of them with what was going on. Although he was always eager to play a role in any crooked scheme that required it of him, he tended to stay within narrower bounds than Locke or Sabitha or even the Sansas. Jean was a consummate straight man, the angry bodyguard, the dutiful clerk, the respectable servant. He was a solid wall for victims of their games to bounce off of, but not the sort to jump back and forth rapidly between roles. Locke set these thoughts aside and tried to imagine himself as Orin. He recalled his own lack of sweet humour each time he was yanked from sleep early, most frequently because of some Sansa mischief. The memory served him well, and he spoke.
"Would you instruct me in the love of my own father? You push presumption to its limits, Ferin. Had I wished to wake to scorn and remonstration, I would have married by now."
Alondo assumed a more energetic persona, more confident and forceful in speech.
"Fairly spoken, O Prince, O Majesty, I cry mercy. I did not come to rudely trample dozy dreams, nor correct you in honouring our lord, your father. Your perfect love for him is reckoned of a measure with your devotion to warm, soft beds, and therefore lies beyond all question."
"Were you not the great friend of my youth,"
said Locke, deciding a laugh would be a good thing to add,
"but the unresting spirit of some foe slain in father's wars, you could scarce do me more vexation, Ferin. Thou art like a marriage, lacking only the pretty face and pleasant couplings. You do so busy my mornings with rebukes, I half forget which of us is royal."
"Good," said Moncrane. "Good enough. Friendly banter, hiding something. Ferin sees his ticket to glory lazing around, accomplishing nothing. These two need each other, and they resent it while trying to hide it behind their good cheer."
"Moncrane, for the love of all the gods, there'll be no play to see and no parts to act if you explain everything at the first chance," said Sylvanus.
"I don't mind," said Alondo.
"Nor I," said Locke. "I think it's helping. Me, at least."
"Moncrane would teach you how to play every part as Moncrane," chuckled Sylvanus. "Don't forget that."
"Not an actor that lives wouldn't make love to the sound of his own voice," said Moncrane, "if only he could. You're no exception, Andrassus. Now, let's find some swords. Ferin talks Orin into practicing in the gardens, and that's where the plot winds them in its coils."
Hours passed in sweat and toil. Back and forth in the sun they pretended to fight, with notched wooden blades musty from storage. Locke and Jean and Alondo rotated roles, and Moncrane even swapped in the Sansas for variety, until it became a sort of whirling pantomime brawl. Stab, parry, recover, deliver lines. Parry, dodge, deliver lines. Parry, deliver lines. Sylvanus procured a bottle of wine and ended his personal drought. He shouted encouragement at the duelists all afternoon, but didn't move once from his chosen spot in the shade, near Sabatha and Janora. As the sun drew down toward the west, Moncrane finally called a halt. "There we are, boys. That's enough for a mild beginning."
"Mild?"
wheezed Alondo. He'd kept his composure for a respectable length of time, but wilted with the rest of them as the muttering and swordplay had drawn on.
"Aye, mild. You're out of condition, Alondo. You young pups have all the leaping about to do and nearly all the speaking. If the audience sees you sucking air like a fish on the bottom of a boat..."
"They'll throw things right," said Alondo. "I've been pelted with vegetables before."
"Not in my company, you haven't," growled Moncrane. "Right, all of you, sit down before you throw up."
The admonition came too late for Carlo, already wobbling from his hangover. He noisily lost whatever remained in his stomach in a far corner of the inn-yard.
"Music to my ears," said Moncrane. "See, Andrasus, so long as I can inspire that sort of reaction in our bold young lads, I believe I may claim not to have lost my touch."
"What do you suppose for us, then?" said Sylvanus.
"The audience might notice, were the Emperor of the Therin throne such a fine, rich, lovely shade of brown as myself, that his son ought not to be a plain pink Therin," said Moncrane. "And the part of the magician requires more moving about, so I'll take it. That leaves you to sit the throne."
"I shall be imperial," sighed Sylvanus.
"Good," said Moncrane. "Now, I need an ale before I'm baked like a pie."
"Emperor, eh?" said Locke, sinking down against the wall next to Sylvanus. "Why so glum? Sounds like a good part."
"It is," said Sylvanus, "for the few lines he has. It's not the father's play, but the son's."
The old man took a swig from his bottle and made no effort to pass it around.
"I envy you little shits. I do, though no one could accuse you of any deep knowledge of the craft."
"What's to envy?" said Alondo. "We're out there melting in the heat while you get to sit in the shade."
"Heh," said Sylvanus. "Spoken like a true lad of none and 20 years. At my age you don't get to sit in the shade, boy. That's where you're sent to keep out of everyone else's way."
"You're being morose," said Alondo. "It's the grapes speaking, as usual."
"This is the first bottle I've touched since my head hit the ground last night," said Sylvanus. "And for me, that's as sober as a babe freshly unwombed. No, gentlemen, I know a thing which you do not. Read any script in our common property, and you'll find too many roles to which you're suited. Soldiers, princes, lovers, fools. You could never play them all if you lived to twice my age, which is a frightful number. At 20, you may be anything. At 30, you may do as you please. At 40, only a few doors ease shut. But 50, ah, here's a sting that Moncrane feels for sure. By 50, you're becoming a perfect stranger to all those parts that once suited you like the skin of your own cock."
Locke had no idea what to say, so he simply watched as Sylvanus finished his bottle and tossed it into the leather-hard mud of the yard.
"I used to skim these plays for all the fine young roles my ambition could bear," he said. "Now I look at the broken parts, the sick men, the forgotten men, and I wonder which of them will be mine. Did you not hear why I'm emperor? Because the emperor need not trouble his fat old ass to move. I am as much entombed as enthroned."
Sylvanus heaved himself to his feet, joints creaking.
"I don't mean to oppress your spirits, boys. Come find me in an hour or two, and I shall be merry.
Yes, I will have quite forgotten anything I've said here, I'm sure.
After Sylvanus had gone inside, Locke rose, stretched, and followed. He had no notion of what, if anything, he should say. In one short afternoon he had grown used to the advantage of having all of his lines scribbled out for him on a piece of paper.
4. Right, said Jasmer, 3 hours into their fifth day of practice under the unfriendly sun. Giovanno, I'm sure you're a fine fellow, but you've got no business saying lines in front of people. I think I can beat your friends into something resembling actors, but you're as useless as gloves on a snake. Said Jean, looking up from his script. What did I do wrong?
If you had any wit for the work, you'd already know, said Jasmer.
Go sit the fuck down and count our money or something.
Hang on, said Locke, who'd been playing Orin to Jean's Ferrin. You've got no business talking to Giovanno like that.
This is the business of the play, said Moncrane, and in this realm I am all the gods on their heavenly thrones, speaking with one voice, telling him to shut up and go away.
Agreed, you can order him around, said Locke, but mind your manners.
Boy, I do not have fucking time.
Yes, you do, said Locke. You always have the time to be polite to Giovanno, and when you don't, we will pack up and go back to Camor. Do I make myself clear?
Hey, said Jean, tugging at Locke's tunic. It's fine.
No, it isn't, said Sabatha, joining Locke and Jean in the center of the courtyard. Lucasa's right, Jasmer. We'll slave for you as required, but we won't eat shit for no reason.
Send me back to jail, muttered Moncrane. Fuck me and send me back to jail.
We shall accommodate neither request, said Sabatha. I can use him, said Genora, appearing from the door to the inn. Giovanno, that is. If he's not going to be on stage, he can help me manage the property and alchemy.
I guess I've got no real choice, said Jean.
And speaking of the common property, said Genora, I've got to tell you now, the mice and red moths have been at it. All the death masks and robes are too scrubby to use, and most of the other costumes are only fit for cutting up as pieces.
Well, then, do so, said Jasmer. I'm busy out here turning dog shit into diamonds. It's only fair you should get to do the same in your line of work.
I need funds, said Genora, and we must have a sit-down, all the stakeholders, and decide where those funds are coming from, and how to address the shares of our friends that cut and ran.
Good gods, said Moncrane.
And on what terms? And I need to hire someone who can handle a needle and thread.
Jean raised his hand.
You can sew, said Genora. What, mending torn tunics and so forth?
I know hemming from pleating, said Jean, and darning from shirring, and I've got the thimble calluses to prove it.
I'll be damned.
Genora grabbed Jean by the arm.
You can't have this one back even if you decide you do need another actor.
I won't, said Moncrane sourly.
Are we taking a break?
Said Carlo, sitting down hard.
Sure, sit on your ass, sweetheart. Those of us still in condition will play for your amusement, said Galdo.
He kicked dirt across his brother's breeches. Carlo didn't even waste time on a dirty look. He lashed out with his legs, hooked Galdo below the knees, and toppled him. Galdo rolled over on his back, clutching at his left wrist, and howled in pain.
Oh, hell, said Carlo, jumping back to his feet. Is it bad? I didn't mean to. Honest. Gnack!
This last extremely unpleasant sound was forced out of him by a kick from Galdo that terminated in Carlo's groin.
Nah, it feels fine, said Galdo. Just having a bit of acting practice.
Locke, Jean, Alondo, Genora, and Sabatha descended on the twins, separating them before Moncrane could get involved in the melee. What followed was a pandemonium of finger-pointing and hard words in which the intelligence, birth city, artistic capacity, work habits, skin colour, dress sense, and personal honour of every participant were insulted at least once. Through it all, the sun poured down relentless heat, and by the time relative order was restored, Locke's head was swimming. He didn't notice that someone had come around the corner from the street until they'd cleared their throat loudly.
"How grand," said the newcomer.
A tall woman of about 30. She wore a tight grey tunic and baggy trousers, and she was of mixed Therin and dark-skinned parentage, though she was lighter than Jasmo or the Gloriano women. Her black curls were cut just above her ears, and she had the sort of cool self-composure that Locke associated with Komori Garistas.
"Jasmo, I'm impressed, but not really in the way I expect it to be."
"Chantal," said Moncrane, conjuring his dignity with the speed of a quick-draw artist, "a fine afternoon to you as well, you opportunistic turncoat."
"You were off to the Weeping Tower," said the woman. "I do like to eat more than once a month. I've got nothing to apologize for."
"What's the matter? Basanti not handing out charity to any more of my strays?"
"Basanti has got work for the taking. But I heard some interesting things. Heard you'd found a patron."
"Yes, it turns out that not all the good taste has been bred out of Espara's quality. Also heard that those Komori you promised weren't a lie after all." "They're all here," said Moncrane. "Count 'em."
"And you're still serious about doing the Republic of Thieves?"
"Serious as a slit throat."
"Is Janora finally getting on stage?"
"Gods above, no," said Janora.
"Aha."
Chantal strolled toward Moncrane. "By my count, you're short at least one woman, then." "What do you care if I am?"
"Look, Jasmo."
Chantal's cat-and-mouse smile vanished.
"Basanti's doing the wine of womanly reverence, and I don't want to spend the summer giggling and flouncing as fetching maid number four. We're in a position to help one another."
"Hmm," said Moncrane. "Depends. Did you drag that husband of yours back over here as well?" As though on cue, a brown-haired Therin man came around the corner behind Chantal. He wore an open white tunic, displaying a rugged physique decorated with dents and scars. Those, and the fact that his right ear was half missing, led Locke to guess that he was either a veteran handball player or an aging swordsman who'd seen the writing on the wall. "Now, of course you did," said Moncrane. "Well, my new young friends, allow me to introduce you to Chantal Cousa, formerly of the Moncrane Company, and her husband, Bertrand the Crowd."
"The Crowd?" said Locke.
"He hops costumes from scene to scene like nobody else," said Alondo. "He's half a dozen bit players in one."
"Him I can use," said Moncrane. "But what makes you think I've forgiven either of you?"
"Cut the crap, Jasmo," said Chantal. "I want decent work. You want a happy audience."
"Dare I ask if there will be any more reverse defections?"
"Not for a basket of rubies the size of your self-regard, Jasmo. They're more worried about being taken in as accomplices to assault and sedition than they are about losing their places in your troupe."
"Well, I say take Bert and Chantal back," said Alondo.
"Likewise," said Janora. "We've got parts to fill, and we don't have time to be choosy. Shall I pry Sylvanus out of bed and see what he thinks?"
"No," said Moncrane. "He'd say yes just because he can't take his eyes off her." "Fine. You're in luck, the pair of you. But it's on wages, no percentage. You know the papers. You lost that when you walked."
"We might have to argue that," said Chantal. "Either way, it's worth it to avoid fetching maid number four. Believe me, I'd much rather be Amadine, Queen of the Shadows."
"I'm ever so sorry," said Sabitha. If the words, "that was a lie," had suddenly sprung up behind her in letters of fire 10 feet high, the effect could scarcely have added to her tone of voice.
"That role is no longer available."
"Are you kidding?"
Chantal strode across the courtyard until she was looking down at Sabitha, who was a handspan shorter than the older woman.
"Who are you, then?"
"Amadine," said Sabitha coolly, "Queen of the Shadows."
"Bloody Komori! You're young enough to have come out from between my legs, but not pretty enough. You can't be serious."
"She certainly can," said Locke. Heat and frustration mingled badly with his acute sensitivity at hearing a stranger say anything uncomplimentary about Sabitha.
"Jasmo, you're mad," said Chantal. "She's no Amadine. Give her Penthra by all means, but not Amadine. What is she, 16? 16, boy-assed and average."
"Average?" said Locke. "Average?
How the hell do you get around the city with two glass eyes in your god's damned head, woman? You've got to be
Before Locke could append the second syllable of that heartfelt but unwisely chosen word, Bertrand the Crowd, true to his appearance, had one rough hand on Locke's tunic collar and was dragging him toward a rendezvous with his other fist, already drawn back. The world moved in horrifying slow motion. Locke, who was no stranger to a beating, was cursed with an uncanny ability to recognize one just before it ceased to be theoretical. A miracle, the size and shape of Jean Tannen, appeared out of the corner of Locke's vision. An instant before Bertrand could throw his punch, Jean hit him shoulder to stomach and slammed him into the dirt.
"Bert!"
shouted Chantal.
"Heavens!" said Genora.
Locke realized he was holding something, and he glanced down to discover that Jean had somehow tossed his precious optics into his hands while separating him from Bertrand. Jean was a round-bellied, quietly dignified boy of about 16. Even his current crop of carefully hoarded stubble failed to lend his aspect any real menace. Bertrand had at least a decade on him, not to mention 6 inches and 20 pounds, and he looked like he could tear a side of beef in half on a whim. What happened next surprised even Locke. Punch was traded for punch. Jean and Bertrand rolled around, a furious tangling of arms and legs, swiping and swatting and straining. The advantage shifted every few seconds. Jean got his hands around Bertrand's throat, only to find the older man hammering at his ribs. Bertrand pinned Jean beneath him, yet the boy somehow kicked his legs aside and pulled him back to the ground.
"Gods above!" said Chantal. "Stop! Stop it already! We can talk about this!"
Jean attempted to hold an arm across Bertrand's neck, and Bertrand responded with something fast and clever that flung Jean forward over his shoulder. When he tried to press his advantage, however, Jean did something equally fast and clever that threw Bert into a wall. The two combatants wrestled again, desperately forming and breaking grips on one another, until at last Jean slipped free and rolled clear. This was a mistake. The older man used the space between them to swing a wild haymaker that clipped Jean across the chin and finally dropped him. A moment later, Bertrand wobbled and fell on his face, just as used up as his younger antagonist.
"Chantal," said Moncrane, "I would have been happier to tell you that the role of Amadine was beyond negotiation, for several reasons. And hot staggering shit! You cannot expect me to believe that boy can do all that and work a thimble, too."
Genora and the gentleman bastards gathered around Jean, while Alondo, Chantal, and Moncrane sought Bert. Both the fighters regained their senses soon enough, and were eased up into sitting positions against the inn wall.
"Optics!" coughed Jean.
When Locke handed them over, he settled them carefully on his nose and sighed with relief.
"Smoke!"
muttered Bertrand. Chantal handed him a sheaf of rolled tobacco and flicked a bit of twist match to light it. Once she'd done this, Bert tore the cigar in two, lit the cold half from the red embers of the other, and passed it over to Jean. The boy nodded his thanks, and the two combatants smoked in peace for a few moments while everyone else watched, dumbfounded.
"You play handball, kid," said Bertrand.
His voice was deep, his Ferrari accent thick.
"Certainly," said Jean. "Come play with my side on Penance Day afternoons. We play for ale money, 2 coppins a man to buy in."
"Love to," said Jean. "Just don't take any more swings at my friends."
"Sure, kid," said Bertrand.
He waved a finger at Locke.
"And you don't talk about my wife like that."
"Then tell your wife not to insult Verena," said Locke.
"Hey there, skinny, we both speak Therin."
Chantal poked Locke sharply in the chest.
"You've got something to tell me? Tell me yourself."
"Fine," said Locke, matching gazes with Chantal. "Don't insult Verena."
"Excuse me," said Sabitha, pushing Locke aside without humor or delicacy. "Did I turn invisible or something? I'm not hiding behind him, Chantal."
Locke winced at the unkind emphasis on him.
"You want to fight your own fights, bitchling?" said Chantal. "Good. Any time you want a real education, you try and throw a—"
"Enough!"
hollered Moncrane in a shake-the-rafters voice, pushing the two women apart.
"Gods damn you all for shit-witted wastrels!
Bring yourselves to order, or I'll go punch another nobleman. I swear it on my balls and bones.
Chantal, sweetness, said Bertrand, blowing smoke. When Jasmer's the voice of reason, you might have to admit it's time to calm down.
Verena's Amadine, said Jasmer. That's the way it is. You can have Penthra, or you can have Fetching Maid Number 4 and shake your tits all summer for Bysanti.
Chantal glowered, then offered a hand to Sabitha. Peace, then. I just hope that when you're on stage, the sun shines out of your backside, girl. Sabitha shook with Chantal. When I'm finished, you won't be able to imagine anyone else as Amadine ever again.
Bertrand whistled and grinned.
Ha! That's good. Give my wife a couple of days to grow on you, Verena. She'll make you like her.
I've had a lot of opportunities in my life to learn tolerance, said Sabitha with a thin smile.
Now, if you're Amadine, said Bertrand, who's Orin? Who gets to do all that kissing and mooning and staring, eh?
Locke's heart seemed to skip a beat.
That's what we were in the business of figuring out when you showed up, said Moncrane.
He rubbed his forehead and sighed.
I suppose I might as well make my decision. I'll hedge our bets. Lucasa, you'll be Ferrin.
I would love to...
Wait, what? Said Locke.
You heard me. Orin's a role that needs more nuance. I want a Londo to handle it.
But...
That's all, said Jasmer. That's it for today. No further discussion. And gods help me, I can quote the company charter as well as Janora can. Next one of you that lays a finger on anyone else here gets docked. Wages, shares, work time. I don't give a damn. I'll spank you like an angry father. Now go.
5. Penthra, muttered Jean, reading aloud from the script in his hands. A fallen noble woman of Therimpel, Amadine's boon companion.
I've read the bloody character list, Jean.
Locke and Jean sat in the corner of Mistress Gloriano's common room farthest from the bar, where Bertrand, Jasmer, Alondo, Chantal, and Sylvanus were drinking up a significant portion of the company's future profits. Dinner was just past.
Wait, are you trying to ignore me?
Yes. Jean closed his copy of the play with a sigh. My ribs ache. I got thrown out of the play. I'm now a bookkeeping stevedore, and you're plumbing new depths of tedium with your moping.
But I...
Seriously, if you want to kiss her on stage so badly, just speak to Jasmer.
He doesn't want to talk about it.
Locke sipped his cup of warm, dark ale, barely tasting it. Says it's an artistic decision and therefore not subject to debate.
Then talk to Alondo.
He acts for a living. Why would he give up the plum role?
I don't know. Because you tricked him? Because you convinced him? Rumour has it you took some lessons in being tricky and convincing.
Yeah, but he's a decent enough fellow. It's not like yanking Jasmer around. Feels wrong.
Then listen here, my friend. I'm not an oracle, and I'm not going to turn into one, no matter how long you sit there crying into your beer. You know I used to think that the Sansas were the biggest annoyance around. I was wrong. Until you and Sabitha get your shit together, they're the least of all possible evils.
She's just so God's damned inscrutable.
You were talking to her before, right?
Yeah. It was going well. Now it's all strange.
Have you considered extreme, desperate measures, like talking to her again?
Yeah, but, well...
You've yeah-butt your way to this point, said Jean. You're going to yeah-butt this mess until it's time to go home, and I don't doubt you'll yeah-butt her out of your life. Quit circling at a distance. Go talk to her, for Priva's sake.
Where is she?
She sneaks up to the roof when the rest of us are down here making idiots of ourselves.
She won't... I don't know. It's not that it's...
Reach between your legs, growled Jean, and find some balls, or you do not get to speak to me on the subject of her for the rest of the summer.
I'm sorry, said Locke. I just hate the thought of screwing things up worse than they are. You know I've got talents in that direction.
Ha, indeed. Try being direct and honest. I can't give you any more specific advice. When the hell have I ever charmed my way under anyone's dress, hm?
All I know is that if you and Sabatha don't reach some understanding, we're all going to regret it. But you most of all.
You're right. Locke took a deep, steadying breath. You're right. Pretty routinely, sighed Jean.
Are you going?
Absolutely.
Not with that beer, you're not. Give it over.
Locke did so with an absent-minded air, and Jean drained the cup in one gulp.
Okay, he said. Go, before your so-called better judgment has a chance to wake back up. Wait, that's not the way up. Where the hell are you going?
Just back to the bar, said Locke. I have a bright idea.
6. Languid, thick-aired evening had come down on Aspara, and the city lights were flicking to life beneath a sky the color of harvest grapes. Mistress Gloriano's crooked gables concealed a little balcony, westward-facing, where two people could sit side by side, assuming they were on good terms. Locke eased the balcony hatch open carefully, peered out, and found Sabatha staring directly at him with eyebrows raised. She lowered her copy of The Republic of Thieves.
Hi,
said Locke, much less confidently than he'd imagined he would as he climbed the little passage from the second floor.
Can I, share your balcony for a little while? I was going over my part.
You expect me to believe you don't already have the whole thing memorized? It was as though she couldn't decide whether to be pleased or exasperated. Locke knew the expression well. After a moment, she set her book down and beckoned him out. He sat down cross-legged, as she was, and they faced one another.
"What's behind your back?" she said.
"A small kindness." He showed her the wineskin and two small clay cups he'd been concealing.
"Or a bribe, depending on how you look at it. I'm not thirsty. If I'd been worried about thirst, I'd have brought you water. I was worried about knives."
"Knives?"
"Yeah, the ones you've had out for a few days now. I was hoping to sort of dull the edges. Isn't that rather knavish, plying a girl with drink?
In this case, it's more like self-defense, and I did sort of think you might just like a cup of wine.
And then perhaps a second, and a third, and so on, until my inhibitions were sufficiently elastic?
I didn't deserve that."
"Yes, well, perhaps not.
Gods, I forgot that anyone who wants to be nice to you has to get permission in advance and wear heavy armor." Biting his lip, Locke poured the pale wine carelessly and slid one of the cups toward her.
"Look, you can pretend it just appeared there by magic if it makes you happy. Is that Anjani orange wine?"
"If it's Anjani, my ass is made of gold," said Locke, sipping from his cup. "But it was some kind of orange, once upon a time."
"And what miracle are you trying to coax out of me exactly?"
"Simple conversation.
What's happened, Sabatha? We were talking, actually talking. It was really nice, and we worked well together. But now you snap for no reason. You find excuses to cut me dead. You keep throwing up these walls, and even when I climb them, I find you've dug moats on the other side."
"You're crediting me with an extraordinary degree of industry," she said, and Locke was delighted to see the tiniest hint of a smirk on her lips, though it vanished between breaths.
"Maybe I'm preoccupied with the play."
"Oh, look," said Locke. "Now the moat is full of spikes. Also, I don't believe you."
"That's your problem."
"What do you have to gain by not talking to me?"
"Maybe I just don't want to."
"But you did," said Locke. "You did, and we were getting somewhere. Do you really want to spend the rest of our stay here doing this stupid dance back and forth? I don't."
"It's not so much a dance, though, is it?" she said softly.
"No," said Locke. "You're the one that keeps stepping back. Why?"
"It's not easy to explain."
"If it was, an idiot like me would have figured the answer out already."
"Can I sit beside you?"
"That's putting the cart before the horse.
The horse is tired and needs a break.
Come on, it'll make it easier to hit me if you don't like what I have to say."
After a pause that seemed to last about 10 years, she turned to look out over the city and patted the stone beside her.
Locke slid over, eagerly but carefully, until his left shoulder was touching her right. The warm wind stirred around them, and Locke caught the faint scents of musk and sage oil from her hair. A thousand fluttering things burst to life in his stomach and immediately found reasons to run all over the place.
"You're trembling," she said, actually turning to look at him.
"You're not exactly a statue yourself.
Are you going to try to make me not regret this, or are you just going to sit there staring?
I like staring at you, said Locke, shocked and pleased at his own refusal to turn from her gaze.
Well, I like heaving boys off rooftops. It's not a habit I get to indulge often enough.
That wouldn't get rid of me. I know how to land softly.
God damn it, Locke, if you've got something you want to say.
I do, he said, steadying himself as though for the incoming swing of a wooden training baton.
I'm tired of talking behind my hands and dropping hints and trying to trick some sort of reaction out of you. These are my cards on the table. I think you're beautiful. I feel like I'm an idiot with dirt on his face sitting next to someone out of a painting. I think I'm just plain stupid for you. I know that's not exactly sweet talk out of a play. Frankly, I'd kiss your shadow. I'd kiss dirt that had your heel print in it. I like feeling this way. I don't give a damn what you or anyone else thinks. This is how it feels every time I look at you. And I admire you, he said, praying that he could blurt everything out before she interrupted him.
This desperate eloquence was like an out-of-control carriage, and if it smashed to a halt, it might not move again.
I admire everything about you. Even your temper and your moods and the way you take God's damned offense when I breathe wrong around you. I'd rather be confused about you than stone-fucking certain about anyone else. Got it? I admire the way you're good at everything you do, even when it makes me feel small enough to drown myself in this wine cup.
Locke, I'm not done. He held up the cup he'd used to illustrate his previous point and gulped its contents straight away.
The last thing, the most important thing, it's this. I'm sorry.
She was staring at him with an expression that made him feel like his legs were no longer touching the balcony stones beneath them.
Sabitha, I'm sorry. You told me that you wanted something important from me, and that it wasn't a defense or a justification, so it has to be this. If I've pushed you aside, if I've taken you for granted, if I've been a bad friend and screwed up anything that you felt was rightfully yours, I apologize. I have no excuses, and I wish I could tell you how ashamed I am that you had to point that out to me.
God damn you, Locke, she whispered. The corners of her eyes glistened.
Twice now? Look, if I said the wrong thing...
No, she said, wiping at her eyes, trying but failing to do so nonchalantly.
No, the trouble is you said the right thing.
Oh, he said. His heart seemed to wobble back and forth in his chest like an improperly balanced alchemist's scale.
You know, even for a girl, that's confusing. Don't you get it? It's easy to deal with you when you're being an idiot. It's easy to push you aside when you're blind to anything outside your own skull. But when you actually pay attention and you actually make yourself act like an adult, I just can't seem to make myself want to keep doing it.
She grabbed her wine cup at last, gulped most of it, and laughed, almost harshly.
I'm scared, Locke.
No, you're not, he said vehemently. Nothing scares you. You may be a lot of other things, but you're never scared.
Our world is this big.
She held the thumb and forefinger of her left hand up, barely an inch apart.
Just like Chains says, we live in a hole, for the gods' sake. We sleep 15 feet apart. We've known each other more than half our lives. What have we ever seen of other men or women? I don't want something like this to happen because it can't be helped. I don't want to be loved because it's inevitable.
Not everything that's inevitable is bad.
I should want someone taller, she said. I should want someone better looking and less stubborn and more... I don't know. But I don't. You are awkward and frustrating and peculiar, and I like it. I like the way you look at me. I like the way you sit and stare and ponder and worry yourself over everything. Nobody else stumbles around quite the way you do, Locke. Nobody else can keep juggling flaming torches while the stage burns down around them like you do. I adore it. And that frightens me.
Why should it? Locke reached out, and his heart threatened to start breaking ribs when she slipped his hand into hers.
Why aren't you entitled to your feelings? Why can't you like whoever you want to like? Why can't you love? I wish I knew.
Suddenly they were on their knees facing one another, hands clasped,
and Sabatha's face was a map of mingled sorrow and relief.
"I wish I was like you." "No, you don't," he said. "You're beautiful, and you're better at just about everything than I am." "I know that, stupid," she said with a widening smile. "But what you know is how to tell the whole world to fuck off. You would piss in Azaguirre's eye, even if it got you 1,000,000 years in hell, and after 1,000,000 years you'd do it again. That's why Carlo and Galdo and Jean love you. That's why that's what I wish I knew how to do."
"Sabatha," said Locke,
"not everything that's inevitable is regrettable. It's inevitable that we breathe air, you know. I like shark meat better than squid. You like citrus wine better than red. Isn't that inevitable? Why the hell does it matter? We like what we like, we want what we want, and nobody needs to give us permission to feel that way." "See how easy it is for you to say that? Sabatha, let me tell you something. You called it silly, but I do remember the first glimpses I ever had of you, when we both lived in Shades Hill. I remember how you lost your hat, and I remember how your red was coming out at the roots. It struck me witless, understand? I didn't even know why, but I was delighted." "What? I have been fixated on you for as long as I've had memories. I've never chased another girl. I've never even gone with the Sansas, you know, to see the gilded lilies. I dream about you, and only you, and I've always dreamt about you as you really are, you know, red, not the disguise."
"What?
Did I say something wrong? You've seen the real color of my hair once." She pulled her hands out of his. "Once, when you were the next thing to a God's damned baby, and you can't get over it, and that's supposed to flatter me? Hold on, please. As I really am? I've kept my hair dyed brown for 10 years. That's how I really am. Gods, I am so stupid. You're not fixated on me. You want to fuck a red-haired girl, just like every leering pervert this side of Jerem. Absolutely not! I mean, you know why I've been dodging slavers all my life? You know why Chains trusted me with a poisoned dagger when Carlo and Galdo were barely allowed to carry orphans' twists? You ever hear the things they say about Therin redheads that haven't had their petals plucked? Wait, wait, wait! Honest, I didn't... I am so, so stupid!"
She shoved him backward, and he crushed his empty wine cup painfully by sitting on it.
"I should have known. I just should have known. You admire me? You respect me? Like hell, I can't believe I was going to... I just... Get out! Get the hell out of here! Wait, please!"
Locke tried to wipe away the haze, suddenly stinging his eyes.
"I didn't mean... Your meaning was quite plain. Go away!"
She threw her own empty cup at him, missing, but speeding his stumbling escape into the little passage down to the second floor. As he tried to roll awkwardly back to his feet, a pair of strong hands grabbed him from behind and hauled him up.
"Jean," he muttered, "thanks, but I..."
The same hands grabbed him, spun him around, and pressed him hard against the passage wall. Locke found himself eye to eye with the new patron of the Moncrane Bulidazi Company.
"Lord Bulidazi!" Locke sputtered. "Gennaro!"
The well-built Asparan held Locke in place with one iron forearm and reached beneath his plain, dusty clothing with the other hand. He pulled out 10 inches of steel, gleaming in the light from the open balcony door, the sort of knife crafted for arguments rather than display cases. In an instant the tip was against Locke's left cheek.
"Cousin," spat Bulidazi, "I thought I'd dress down and come see how my investment was faring. The idiots in the taproom said you might be up here. That's a fascinating conversation you've been having, cousin, but it leaves me feeling like there's a few things you haven't exactly been telling me."
The knife tip pressed deeper into Locke's skin, and he groaned.
"Like everything," said Bulidazi, "why don't we start with everything?"
Part 3. Fatal Honesty. I never knew any more beautiful than you. I have hunted you under my thoughts. I have broken down under the wind and into the roses looking for you. I shall never find any greater than you. Carl Sandburg, from The Great Hunt. Chapter 8. The Five-Year Game. Infinite Variation. 1.
"Someone's gonna recognize us," said Locke.
"We look like hell,"
said Jean, practicing understatement at the master level.
"Just two more travelers covered in dust and shit."
"Valentine must have returned by now. Sabatha's got to have people watching the gates." Locke tapped the side of his head. "You and I would."
"That's a generous appraisal of our foresight."
It had been a hard 4 days back to Carthane. They'd looted the wagon and shoved it into a ravine on the second day, needing every scrap of speed they could coax out of their unyoked team. Lachaine's constables were no threat, but the previous occupant of the wagon could always hire mercenaries. There was no law on the long, ancient road between city-states. A column of dust rising rapidly in the sky behind them would probably have meant someone was going to die. Now the city, finally in sight, had taunted them for half a day with the prospect of relative safety. They'd come up the coast road from the east, through hills and terraced farming villages, their bodies thoroughly punished by the seedy emergency saddles they'd filched from the wagon.
"Maybe you're right, though," said Jean. "If we've got no chance of hiding ourselves, we've got to rely on speed. We get one move, maybe, before she can respond."
"Let's go straight for her," said Locke. His scowl shook little puffs of dust out of the creases of his road-grimed face.
"To do what?"
"Finish a conversation."
"You in a hurry to get back to sea? I can handle a couple of her people at a time. She's got more than a couple."
"Taken care of," said Locke. "I know a fellow who'll be eager to help us pass the guards."
"You do?"
"Didn't you notice that Vordratha favors tight breeches?"
"What the hell's that got to do with anything?"
"Every little detail matters," said Locke. "Just wait. It'll be a fun surprise."
"Well, shit," said Jean. "It's not like I've done anything especially smart in months. Why start now?"
2. They slipped into traffic and the usual milling semi-confusion of customs inspectors, guards, teamsters, travellers, and horse manure. The court of dust, despite the general cleanliness of Carthane, could have been peeled up beneath its paving stones and set down in place of its counterpart in nearly any Therin city without arousing much notice. Locke scanned the crowds as he and Jean were poked and prodded by bored constables. Sabatha's spotters would most likely be working in teams, one person on watch while the other was always plausibly absorbed in some trivial business. After counting 5 possible pairs of watchers, Locke shook his head. What was the point? Locke felt something else unusual going on, though. A buzz of activity around the court, beyond mundane business. He'd spent too many hours picking pockets in crowds like this not to sense that something was awry. Jean was alert, too.
"What's the excitement?"
he asked of a passing constable.
"It's the Marrows, you ain't heard?"
The woman gestured toward a crowd forming around a battered statue of a Therin-throned noblewoman.
"Cryer's just about to start up again."
Locke saw that a young woman, her fingers' width over 4 feet tall, had climbed the statue pedestal. She wore the blue coat of Carthane, and standing below her was a man in the regalia worn by Herald Vidalos, tipstaff and all.
"Kind attention, citizens and friends of Carthane," bellowed the woman.
Locke was impressed. There had to be more leather lining her lungs than his saddle.
"Hear this report of the facts as provided and authorized by the Conseil. Mendacity will not be tolerated. Rumor mongers will be subject to incarceration on the penance barges. Venceslav Valgasha, King of the 7 Marrows, is dead. He is known to have died in the city of Vintila 6 days ago. He died without issue and without lawful heir. A war of succession is now underway. The canton of Emberlane, easternmost of the 7 Marrows, has exiled its ruling Graf and declared itself to be a sovereign republic. The Conseil of Carthane declines to formally recognize Emberlane at this time, and strongly advises citizens of Carthane to avoid all travel in the north until the situation stabilizes."
"Holy hells," said Locke. "Sabatha was right. The marrow's finally busted up. Gods, what a mess that's going to be."
"We won't be able to pull the Ostershell in brandy scam again," said Jean. "Not for a good long while."
"There'll be other opportunities," said Locke wistfully. "If it's war, desperate people are going to be moving a lot of valuable things. But come on, we've got to move ourselves."
They spurred their tired mounts down a broad avenue to the west, over a shaking and sighing glass bridge, through the Court of the Divines with its incense haze, and onto the evening terrace. It seemed surreal to be back on clean streets, among lush gardens and bubbling fountains, as though Carthane were more of a recurring dream than a real place. Outside the sign of the Black Iris, they aroused immediate interest. At least two watchers, unmistakably real, flashed hand signs to dark shapes on roofs. A fleet-footed child darted into the alley beside Sabatha's headquarters. Locke led their bedraggled horses to a curbside spot more commonly used for carriages, and when he hopped down, a cloud of road dust floated off his boots. He wobbled and nearly pitched over before seizing control of himself. His legs felt like prickly jelly. His horse, less than endeared to him, flicked its ears and snapped its teeth. "These animals are the personal property of Verena Galante," Locke said to the anxious-looking footman. "She wants them well looked after."
"But, sir, if you please—"
"I don't. Get them stabled." Locke shoved past the man and reached for the door to the foyer, but Jean pushed his hand aside and went first. Inside were the two alley hounds Locke had seen last time.
"Oh, hell,"
said the closest one. Jean was already inside his guard. A variety of fast, noisy, and painful things happened, none of them to Locke or Jean. As one guard hit the floor, Jean pitched his comrade face first through the lobby doors like a battering ram. Then the gentleman bastards followed. Here was Vordratha, impeccably dressed and with a fresh black iris pinned to his jacket, backed by four guards with truncheons in hand. Better-dressed people scattered for the doors and staircases behind them.
"Gentlemen," said the major domo, peering at the guard who just landed at his feet. "This is a members-only establishment with firm rules against rendering the help unconscious."
"Your game now, Lazari,"
said Jean. "Thanks." Locke put his hands up to show they were empty. "Please take us to Mistress Galante immediately."
"Now how can I do that, gentlemen, when you'll be headed out the alley door presently with bruises on your skulls?"
"We'd really like to see her." Before the guards could crowd in, Locke moved up to Vordratha, reached down to the man's breeches, grabbed his balls through the silk, and gave them a considerable twist.
"Or we'd like to see your physicus face when he gets a look at the bruises from this."
Vordratha moaned, and his face turned shades of a colour rarely seen outside of vineyards at harvest time. The guards edged forward, but Locke held up his free hand.
"Call your friends off," said Locke. "I'm not a strong man, but I don't have to be, do I? I'll twist this thing so tight you'll piss corkscrews for the next 20 years.
"Do as he says, gods damn you," gasped Vordratha.
"Simply take us to Verena," said Locke, watching as the guards slowly backed away, "and I'll return your valuable property to you without lasting damage." It was an awkward shuffle, with Vordratha stumbling backward and Locke maintaining his tight, twisted grip on the majordomo's hopes of procreation, but it did the job of keeping the guards at bay.
"Well, how now, asshole?" said Locke. "No little quips for us? I've never steered a fellow along by his loot sack before. Sort of like steering a boat by the tiller."
"Kamari, dog, your mother sucked!"
"If you finish that thought," said Locke, "I'll wind your precious bits tighter than a bowstring."
Vordratha led Locke and Jean up a flight of stairs to the private dining hall where they'd met Sabatha before. The guards maintained a respectful distance, but followed en masse. Vordratha bumped the door to the hall open with his backside, and Locke saw that Sabatha was already waiting for them. She was dressed sensibly for anything from signing papers to diving out windows, in black breeches, a short brown jacket, and riding boots. Her hair was wound around lacquered pins. Doubtless they contained tricks or weapons, or both. Behind her were three more guards, armed with coshes and bucklers. "Hello again, Verena," said Locke. "We were in the neighborhood and thought we'd investigate persistent rumors that Master Vordratha has no balls."
"Isn't this a bit crude, even by your relaxed standards?" said Sabatha.
"I suppose having your boot print embedded in my ass makes me cranky," said Locke. "Tell your friends to go away."
"Oh, that sounds lovely. Shall I tie myself up for you as well?"
"We just want to talk.
Release Vordratha, and we'll talk as long as you like."
"The instant I release Vordratha, all hell's going to break loose. I'm not stupid, for a change."
"I promise."
"Ha!" shouted Locke. "Please."
"We have no basis for trust, then."
"You've given us no basis for trust. I wasn't the one."
"This is getting personal."
Sabatha glared at him with real irritation. She was always less in control of herself when pushed, a hot anger in direct contrast to Jean's cold fury. Locke had spent years desperately straining to read her, and he saw now that she had no clever plan for ending this standoff. His own position, his safety assured only so long as he could keep a grip on another man's privates, suddenly struck him as painfully ridiculous. "I want to speak to you," he said slowly. "Nothing more. I won't harm you or try to take you from this place. I swear it absolutely on the souls of two men we both loved."
"What could you—"
With his free hand, Locke made two of the old private signals. "Carlo, Galdo." Sabatha stared at him, then something broke behind her eyes. Relief? At any rate, she nodded.
"Everyone out," she said. "Nobody lays a hand on these men without my orders. Release Vordratha."
Locke did. The majordomo slumped to the ground and curled up in a half-moon of misery. Sabatha's guard slowly backed out of the room behind her, and Jean crouched over Vordratha.
"I'll get him out of here," he said. "I think you two want some privacy."
In a moment, Jean had carried the slender Vadran out the way they'd come, and Locke was once again facing Sabatha in an empty room.
"We can't just use those names as magic words every time we find ourselves at cross-purposes," she said.
"I know, but it's not my fault. I even had to—"
"Spare me."
"No!" Locke trembled with hunger, adrenaline, and emotion. "I will not be shrugged off. I will not have my feelings pushed aside for the convenience of whatever pose you think you're adopting here."
"Your feelings? We're in Carthane working for the Bonds Magi, damn it. We're not children fumbling around in the back of a wagon."
"You used me."
"And that's what we do," she said, "both of us, professionally. I tricked you, and I meant to trick you, and I'm sorry that hurts, but this is our trade."
"Not this. You didn't just trick me. You used the deepest feelings I ever had for anyone, and you knew it. You exploited a weakness that only exists when I'm around you."
"Woman convinces man to impale himself on his own hard-on. There's a very old story. The world didn't stop just because it happened again."
"I'm not an infant, Sabatha. I'm not talking about sex. I'm talking about trust."
"I put you on that ship for your own god's damned good, Locke. I knew this would happen. I didn't just need you out of the way, and I wasn't just minding your health. I knew you'd beat your brains out against your stupid obsession."
"Oh, marvelous. Lovely fucking plan, because I certainly didn't think about you once during the 9 days it took to get back to Carthane."
She had the good grace to glance away.
"What the hell is this, anyway? First you don't need to justify yourself at all, and now it was for my own good?"
Locke, feeling hot, angrily unbuttoned the stained, oversized riding jacket he'd taken from the stolen carriage.
"And you are not a stupid obsession.
I'm a grown woman who's telling you we cannot wind the clock back 5 years just because you can't work up the courage to make a pass at someone else."
"Courage? Who the hell do you think you are, telling me about my courage? Courage is what it takes to come after you. Courage is what it takes to put up with your self-righteous God's damned martyr act."
"You cocksure, self-entitled, swaggering little ass.
Tell me you never liked me," said Locke, advancing step by step. "Tell me you never found me worthwhile. Tell me we didn't have good years together. That's all it would take."
"Stubborn, fixated.
tell me you weren't pleased to see me. Presumptuous? Quit telling me things I already know. They were suddenly less than a foot apart. Quit making excuses. Tell me you can't stand me. Otherwise, you... Whew, Locke, in faith, you reek. Is that a surprise? What was I supposed to do, swim back to Carthane? You were supposed to stay on the damned ship. I gave very specific directions about the availability of baths, for one thing.
If you wanted me to stay on the ship, he said, you should have been on it.
You look ridiculous.
Locke fought for self-control as Sabatha slowly ran two fingers down his left cheek.
You look bow-legged. Gods above, did you leave any dust on the road after you passed?
You can't, can you?
Can't what?
Can't tell me to get lost. Not to my face, not now that I've called you out. You don't really want me to go away.
I do not have to explain myself by your terms.
Better cinch up that jacket, Sabatha. I think your conscience is showing.
We are servants of the bonds, Magi, she whispered angrily. We came here of our own free will, and we both screwed things up badly enough that we need this. Our position is precarious, and if we get too friendly, at least one of us gets killed.
I know, he said. I'm not saying we don't need to be careful. I'm just pointing out that there's nothing forbidding us from having a personal life.
Everything personal is business with us.
She brushed the dust from his cheek against her coat.
And all of our damned business is personal.
Have dinner with me.
What?
Dinner. It's a meal. Men and women often have it together. Ask around if you don't believe me.
For this you twisted my Major Domo's balls off?
You said we're not kids fumbling around in the back of a wagon, and you're right. We're in charge of our own God's damned lives, no matter how hard we've been kicked around. We can set the clock back however many years we like. It's ours to set.
This is crazy.
No. 2 weeks ago, I was begging to die. That's crazy. 2 weeks ago, I came this close. This close.
He held up a thumb and forefinger with no space at all between them.
I hit the black wall between this life and the next, believe me. I am through fucking around. Maybe this is going to complicate the hell out of things, so what? You're the complication I want more than anything else. You're my favorite complication, no matter what sort of holes you poke in my trust.
You know, self-pity is the only thing that smells worse than 4 days of road sweat.
Self-pity is about the only straw left to cling to after you happen to a fellow, said Locke. We can have this if we both want it, but you have to want it too. This isn't me trying to convince you of anything, unless...
Unless?
Unless some part of you is already convinced.
Dinner,
she said softly.
And a contractual option for subsequent complications, at your discretion.
She couldn't or wouldn't meet his gaze during the silence that filled the next few seconds. Locke's blood seemed to turn to gel in his veins.
Where are we going?
She said at last.
How the hell should I know? Relief hit so hard he wobbled on his feet.
Sabatha's right arm darted out and caught him around the waist. They both stood staring at the point of contact for a long, frozen moment, and then she drew back again.
Are you all right?
She said softly.
I guess I really liked your answer. But come now, how much time have you left me to figure out where anything is in this damned city? You're morally obligated to pick the place tomorrow night.
Let it be sunset, she said. Do you trust me to send a carriage?
Jean and I won't be together, said Locke. We'll make sure of it. If I don't come back in a reasonable amount of time, you can face him, pissed off and unrestrained. How's that for a safeguard?
Not trouble I'd invite if I could help it.
She put her hands behind her back and regarded him appraisingly.
What now?
Depends. Do I still have an inn to go home to?
I've left Justin alone, mostly.
Well, then, I've got to go soothe my children and, figure out just how the hell I'm going to beat you.
Cocksure, infuriating little shit, she said without malice.
Arrogant bitch, he said, grinning as he backed toward the door. Arrogant, stubborn, gorgeous bitch. And hey, if I catch one whiff of that perfume you were wearing last time...
If I catch one whiff of horses and road sweat, you're going back to sea.
I'll take a bath. Take two, and I'll see you tomorrow, then.
You will, said Locke.
He reached the door, crediting himself with enough wits not to turn his back on her, at least not yet. He was about to leave when another thought struck him.
Oh, you know, we did borrow some horses to get here. We put them in a bad way. Would you mind stabling the poor things?
I'll clean up after you, sure. And...
Yes?
Is Jean all right? His face?
He broke his nose getting off your ship. He'll be fine. You know what it takes to really slow him down. It occurs to me, though, that you still have his wicked sisters.
I'll give them back. Soon.
She smiled thinly.
They can be my hostages for your good behavior.
If you need hostages, you could always try a gentler version of what I just did to Vord.
Get the fuck out of here,
she said, fighting back a laugh.
3. So what did you get us? Said Jean.
A dinner date, said Locke. I think I should be able to discuss drawing a few sensible lines so none of us have to worry about waking up halfway to sea again. They'd walked out nonchalantly and claimed the first waiting carriage for hire, which was now rattling toward more friendly territory through the slanting late afternoon shadows of the city's towers.
I assume you mentioned my sisters.
She'll give them back if I behave.
Fine, then.
Jean's voice still had an alarming nasal quality, and Locke made a mental note to have him examine